The Football Show on Off The Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
I'm prepared to do anything I can to play my country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
And you're welcome along to the Football Show this evening. It's myself, Johnny Ward, joined by Daniel McDonald. This, of course, is the week of the Champions League semi-finals, which really we can't wait for. We're going to be joined by Pat Nevin, who'll be looking back at what was a pretty exciting weekend, of course, in the English Premier League, unless you're a Liverpool fan. And we'll also have Leon Blanch on, and Leon will be talking through the Champions League games that are upcoming. So we have a pretty packed show coming up. How are you, Dan?
I'm good, Johnny. How are you, man?
Not too bad. How was your weekend?
Ah, sure, it's all right, you know. Can't complain. It was reasonably busy. Out at the under-17 squad announcement this morning. So that's obviously something that's coming around the corner. I think people are broadly probably aware of it because there's been a few interviews. I know Colin O'Brien's been in here. But the fact is, like, there's a European under-17 championships taking place here across the next couple of weeks. So in hindsight, people will realise there's some brilliant players. I mean, they should have the foresight to go along, but I think it's one of these ones, this under-17 tournament, that in a couple of years to come, there'll be these household names. We'll be like, geez, he was playing in Tonka Park or Whitehall or wherever the various venues are. There's sort of Whitehall and Tolka are in action, and then there's obviously, you know, spread around Dublin and just a bit beyond as well. Ireland are playing then in Waterford next week, so that's coming up. So between that and there's coming to the end of the season in England, so there's obviously quite a few Irish stories of note going on there at the moment too, in tandem with obviously the broader Premier League picture.
Yeah, John Egan's leading the celebrations from Sheffield United's pretty epic promotion as well, and well able to sing a song.
Well, I mean, I don't know about that. I mean, I think people might have heard at this stage. I'm not sure if it's like, I think the quality of his defending has been better this year than maybe the quality of his voice after a weekend of celebrations, to be fair. But
great Irish story.
Yeah, it's a great story. I mean, it's you know, a club with four Irish players coming up, albeit Scott Hogan's on loan. You know, it's possibly unlikely he might be there next year. But the three lads, John Egan, Enda Stevens and David McGoldrick, they've been integral members of their promotion charge. I think Egan and Stevens have both played 44 out of 45 games, and McGoldrick something similar, albeit a few more off the bench. And basically, like, three players who have all dealt with adversity of various types. I mean, Egan broke his leg when he was younger and was almost struggling to stay in the game, and he's climbed his way up from Gillingham to the Premier League level now. Enda Stevens, we'd be fairly familiar with him from Shamrock Rovers, went over to Aston Villa probably too much too soon, and he dropped down to League Two as well. And then David McGoldrick, who pretty much hasn't been fit for a full season until this year. And all three of them, you'd think, are going to get a chance. The manager, Chris Wilder, has done a great job. And I think in all three cases, again, he's seen something in those players. I think Stevens was on loan at League Two at Northampton when Wilder saw him. And, you know, the relationship is there, and similar with the other players. So,
how much of a fear is there that they'll struggle next season to either get their game or with the kind of quality of the Premier League?
I think that's probably negative thinking, because I think Matt Doherty faced the same questions last.
Doherty.
Doherty to our English friends. But Matt Doherty would have faced, there would have been similar question marks last summer with regard to him, and he wasn't replaced at all. Actually, the left wing back effectively was joined Leeds. So, yeah, of course. I mean, you don't know. The honest answer is that you don't know. But, like, certainly, like, McGoldrick, the people who've trained on him have said that he's always had the quality. It was just fitness. Egan is fairly young, and he plays in a back three, again, sort of similar, and Stevens is a wing back. And seems to be suited the position, and probably wasn't up to it when he was younger at Premier League level. I think almost by his own admission, I don't think he was ready for it. So, but they're of an age, the two, you know, Egan and Stevens, that it's a bit like Doherty. You'd be foolish to write them off. But yeah, it's a challenge, the test. People will get found out, but I think they're on. I mean, you like racing parlance, you know, they're progressive, you know, in terms of their where they're at in terms of their career. So you would hope that there's more to come from them.
Just is there more to come from Shane Long at this stage? He's had a major renaissance for his club, obviously. Is this going to translate to maybe Mick McCarthy looking more serious?
Yeah, maybe we can chat about that a bit more later. But, like, it's I mean, he's someone who you would think at this stage, you wouldn't expect there to be improvement as such. I mean, he is 32. He's maybe because Shane Long is fresh-faced and he has a sort of a explosive athletic style that it seems unusual to use the language veteran. But like, there'd be other lads who'd be 32 who'd maybe be a bit lighter on top and, you know, would carry themselves in a particular way in the pitch and they'd be described as a veteran. But Shane Long, he's a bit more exuberant. It's a slightly, it doesn't seem like a fitting tag for him. But you have to be sort of happy for him that after taking the knocks pretty consistently and being the butt of a joke every time he scored, almost, although it wasn't that often, that now, if he can almost...
You think he's quite streaky, though, do you?
Oh, completely streaky. I mean, throughout his career, a lot of his goals tend to come in patches. Mm. You know, they wouldn't be spread across the season, but then he gets a hot streak. But it would be nice for him to score a goal and it not to be a sort of a punchline,
yeah.
You know,
in
some respects.
That he
just gets back just to scoring goals on a relatively regular basis. And he's got over a year left in his contract, which is a good contract. And he probably hasn't been doing enough to justify that, and he said that himself. But I think now, yeah, it's maybe this particular manager. I mean, he had a very good time under Ronald Koeman, and then he left. So maybe, you know, maybe with Hasenhüttl, for some reason, there's a
connection.
It's working. It's a connection, and maybe there's still time for him to deliver. We always feel with Shane Long, we're looking for him to deliver on the potential that's there to some degree. At 32, it's a bit of a strange conversation to have, but on his day, he can still be very dangerous.
Yeah, I just want to plug something that's coming up that'll be very interesting to the long-suffering Liverpool fans. And Dan and I were actually talking about this before the show. Memories of Steve McManaman, brilliant player he was for Liverpool back in the day, probably a bit before he signed. But Off the Ball will be live from the Aviva Stadium this Thursday. That's the 2nd of May, and that's for a Liverpool special. And we do want you to join us for that. We'll be previewing the second leg of the Champions League semi-finals in the company of Liverpool legend Steve McManaman. He'll be alongside Kenny Cunningham and Nathan Murphy. And the only way to enjoy it is to actually go along to the Aviva Stadium in Lansdowne Road. Get your tickets now at offtheball.com/events. That's our Liverpool special with Steve McManaman on Thursday, May 2nd, with thanks to Boyle Sports.
Lifted over the top of Lukaku, shows through and goal, back it goes from Mata, and Mata puts it in! Juan Mata with the opening goal, 10.5 minutes in, after some brilliant approach work from Lukaku and Luke Shaw. 11 minutes on the clock, and it's Manchester United 1, Chelsea 0. Oh, it's been dropped by De Gea, and it's turned off the post and in by Marcus Alonso. Another shocking mistake from David De Gea. A multitude of those from him in recent weeks, and he's gifted Marcus Alonso an equaliser.
Pat Nevin is on the line. How are you, Pat?
I'm very well, very well. How are you too? Johnny and Danny, how are you doing?
Memories of Steve McManaman.
Yeah, no, very, very good player. Played against him quite a few times. He's kind of classy. He's kind of likeable player. You know, even though you're playing against the opposition and there's not a team that you really like or enjoy playing against, you couldn't actually get angry with him because he always just tried to do the right thing. Pure skill as much as anything else. So a guy who could play quite easily and be in the top level now at just about any team. So that basically says, oh, top quality.
Was that a very young McManaman you encountered, Pat? Like at what sort of what stage? And could you see it then, I suppose, from that point?
Well, to be honest, you know, if you're really honest about it, see when you're playing against the likes of Liverpool, there's so much quality all over the place in those days. I mean, they were just an absolutely phenomenal team and he was just coming through. So, and the other thing is, you don't really concern yourself too much with the opposition. You're too busy trying to win yourself. You're too busy worrying about your own players. But you look over the other side of the pitch with that Liverpool side at the time where he was coming through with a new group, you know, that he comes after, you know, Barnsley and Rushy and all them, and a new group coming through, obviously with Fowler and a whole bunch of others. And they were a really good quality group of young players that were, yeah, genuinely world-class eventually. Could I tell right at the time? Nah, but I knew he was a good player.
Yeah, I think what maybe broke the mould with McManaman as well was that he did obviously go to a different country to play at the top level, which remains somewhat anomalous for English players, Pat. Obviously, you know, it's an exception rather than the rule, and McManaman could cut it as well because I guess he was technically proficient.
The other thing that people tend to forget when they look at it now and they say, oh, why did you not go and play abroad? They only allowed three foreign players per team when you were going generally. So you're going to move to Italy. I can remember a period of time when I was at Chelsea and I was told that AC Milan were watching me. And I got excited for the precisely 5 minutes until I realised that they had Ruud Gullit, Van Basten and Rijkaard. And I thought, nah, I don't think I'm going there. Like, you know, it's not happening. So it was kind of a little bit tougher to move abroad then. I had the chances to go to places at Galatasaray, Paris Saint-Germain. But those leagues, I would look at them sometimes and think, are they as good as our league? So if you moved, you had to move to a top league. And that's why Maka, he was good enough to move to the very, very top, and obviously in Madrid. So it wasn't the fact always that people were disinterested in going. There were actually very few spaces available.
Yeah, McManaman was around in obviously that very good Liverpool team that, you know, came fairly close to winning the Premier League. Unfortunately, Pat, if you are a Liverpool fan, the wait is likely to go on, it would seem.
Yeah, it looks a wee bit like that. I was, I've watched them quite a few times in the flesh this season. The last time against Chelsea, I thought they were absolutely brilliant. They're just flying against teams. No one can live with them at the moment. I would argue they're the best team in the league at the moment. They're playing the best football. They look least likely to lose a game. Problem is, Man City don't look very likely either to lose a game. And just those points that they drop. Now, that's taking nothing away from Liverpool. I mean, I'm sure you've all looked at it. I mean, that's an amazing run that they're on just now. But look at the last couple of points that they dropped. They dropped a couple of points against Everton and a couple of points against Man United. Do you think the fans of those two clubs are going to mention that in the future if Liverpool don't win the title by the odd point here and there? The Evertonians will say, yeah, it was us. We killed it for them. So that's a painful thing to take care of. But let's be honest, Liverpool have been brilliant. It's been a great season. I've loved watching them. I've loved going to see them. And the game I was at the weekend, I was at Manchester City when they visited Burnley at the weekend. And they struggled. They really struggled. It wasn't particularly pleasant to watch. They were trying to do their kind of thing, but for a variety of reasons, they couldn't do it anywhere near their usual quality on the day.
Did you ever get any sort of, thought process in the game that they actually might struggle to win? I know they scored in, 65 minutes or all that, but against that, they're playing opposition who were basically not creating anything. But did Liverpool fans kind of garner some hope as the game went on?
It's kind of weird. I was doing for BBC, News Talk was right in front of me, actually. And I was explaining about 30 minutes in. It's kind of an odd thing to say. It's one of those things you say and you think, right, I'm going to get hammered on Twitter for this. But Man City's problem was the pitch. The pitch was a nightmare for them. It was dry. It was too dry. And I'm saying that during the commentary. They can't move it about quickly on the pitch. So they can't play their game. But they're still creating chances, and Burnley are creating precious few. But you get the feeling, having watched Burnley against Chelsea last week and being at that game and watching Burnley have less than 20% possession, but they still managed to score two goals. You knew they were always capable of doing it. So it wasn't a foregone conclusion. There was some hope. Once that goal went in, what happened tactically after that was incredible. Eventually, they were playing with a four-man back line in Manchester City that looked like a Burnley back line, just four centre-backs, and then two centre-backs sitting in front of that. When was the last time you ever seen Pep Guardiola do that? It was unbelievable, trying to kill time in the corners. It was so unlike Pep. But did you think they were really likely to lose a goal? Probably not. Have a look at the results recently. They've been scraping by time and time again. Manchester City, they've learned how to win ugly. And by the way, afterwards, I made sure one of the BBC guys went downstairs and asked Pep about the dry pitch. Thank goodness he agreed. I could have looked like a right idiot.
Because, I mean, you mentioned that, Pat, it's about winning ugly, and there is a pattern, another pattern as well, though, that both the games in the past week, that after half-time, maybe they've just changed things a small bit and adapted that particular game. I mean, was that something that was striking yesterday that, I mean, maybe you'll tell me otherwise, but it did seem like the 15, 20 minutes after half-time that they can maybe just, there's maybe a small little gear they find or a tactical tweak they make. There's something that they're able to muster up when they are struggling a bit.
Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I have to say, various people having different ideas about it. I felt they went to a 4-1-4-1 after the break. But the odd thing was Sterling was still, you know, kind of almost inside forward kind of position. He wasn't out wide. He wasn't up front all the time. So I thought it was a 4-1-4-1, and it still didn't look brilliant. You know, Sterling's been amazing since he's been going wide, stretching teams in those sort of areas. But he seemed to adapt the whole team to try and get Leroy Sané in the team. And it wasn't working for him. Sonny on the day. So it had Bernardo Silva wide, Sterling one inside. And to be honest, they weren't working together at all. So that wasn't working in the first half. His slight adaptation in the second half, it worked a wee bit better, but not fabulously well. But that's all you need, I suppose, a wee bit better, no more than that. The guy who was outstanding on the day, when you watched the entire game, was Aguero. He always looked the most likely to score, always looked most up for it. I think he's actually carrying a little bit of an injury as well. But that's what it came down to. The one bit of genius for the one special player. And tactically, I adore Pep what he does. Not sure the tactics won at this time. I think it was a one bit of, you know, eventually a bit of class from one top player.
Yeah, because I wondered even at full time, and then you get much more of a sense on the ground that you always say, I don't know, was there fatigue or just draining at full time, that I suppose this is the end of a really busy run that they've had, and they've got 8 days now till the next game. I mean, was there any sense that maybe, you mentioned Aguero maybe carrying an injury, but that there was any element of fatigue in some ways about how they played?
Yeah, there was with some players. But I actually don't think it was that. That was partial. I mean, if you look at all the teams just now, did Tottenham look fatigued? Yeah. Did Chelsea look fatigued? Yeah. Did Manchester United? Yeah. Did Arsenal? Yeah. All the teams that have had long runs in Europe and a bunch of players that have played in the World Cup, they're all tired. They're definitely 100%. Somehow Liverpool managed not to be. They're the team that don't look as if they've got it, although they've had to put up with a couple of injuries. But fatigue's part of it. But in actual fact, it's painful to say it, and I won't get a lot of backup, but this is the way it is. It was the pitch. It was hilarious. You to watch a game 30 minutes in and then say, that's too dry, they can't play. And then every single fan around the world is going, you what? You get paid that much and you can't play in a little dry pitch. But it's the way they play. It's really striking. The last time I seen it, can I remember the game earlier in the season when Spurs played Manchester City at Wembley, and it was played after an NFL game?
Yeah.
And I watched those guys trying to play that slick football on that bobbly pitch. They couldn't do it. Absolutely couldn't do it. It was hopeless.
It's interesting you say that, because it's something we frequently talk about, unfortunately, in Ireland, because the pitches are quite hit and miss. And with summer football over here, a lot of the pitches are too dry. But, you know, the football nowadays is improving, because you look back at old Premier League games, there are a lot of bad pitches then, and you just don't expect that now, because it doesn't matter how good you are. If the pitch is bad, it's going to suffer exponentially.
Tell me about it. I had 850 games on rubbish pitch.
Imagine what you could have been, Pat.
But, you know, it's the weirdest thing about it. It's like you try running with the ball. There were times when I played, and even early days Premier League, players would decide to run on the ball when they were wide because there was more grass out there. Try to run through the middle, there was too bobbly and things. So, yeah, it changed. But people will say it's much, much easier now. I'm not going to go boringly technical on you, but some of the modern pitches are a bit rubbish. They look great, but it's like playing in a piece of tarmac painted green. So they try and play. And also it's the style of play. You know, that zippy passing play that you play, you know, it suits because it's that type of pitch. So you make the best use of it. What was quite funny, if I could digress onto Burnley for a second, it was really funny watching them playing against Chelsea earlier in the week when Sean Dyche said his team weren't wasting time. So after the game, I went and timed some of it, right? These players spent 9 minutes on the ground, right? Which led to 5 minutes extra time, right? Injury time, fine. And the other bit was, of the last 11 minutes of the game, the ball was on the pitch just over 4 minutes. It was like, it was a genius, a piece of genius. And by the way, I'm not slaughtering Dyche for this. I admire him for it. It's the referee who needs to sort that out. But the best bit about the dry pitch, it wasn't a fluke. It was absolutely set up. And the reason I can tell you is because before the game, I was looking at the pitch thinking, oh, it looks really nice. Oh, they're only watering one half of it. That's weird. And I kept on watching. And they only watered the half that Burnley were going to attack. But of course, that's a bit harsh on Man City, because their bit wasn't watered and they couldn't play. And then I had a bet with John Murray, who I was working with at halftime. Bet they don't water this pitch at halftime. Every pitch in the Premier League's watered at halftime. Sean Dyche knew what he was doing. It was a tactic, and it was genius, absolutely genius. You've got to use everything, and I was really impressed with him by using it. just didn't help Man City.
If I may digress a bit as well, actually, just you're on about spending time on the ground there and how much that was a tactic. We saw in the Leeds game, obviously, yesterday, the whole absolute shambles that occurred after the, you know, the first Leeds goal, and we see footage there of the Villa players absolutely enraged by
Conor Hurren in the middle of it.
But somebody suggested I can't recall. Somebody was suggesting on Twitter, Pat, that it would be beneficial to football if physios were allowed to come on during the game and just get on with it. Players would no longer be feigning injury because it wouldn't be worth their while, and you wouldn't necessarily have that situation yesterday, resulting in this kind of clamour to put the ball out of play, which at times is questionable in the first place.
2 points there. Number one point, I like the idea of a trial of letting the physios come on. The physios are not allowed to come on unless the referee, you know, ushers them on. Can I tell you, 100% of physios will ignore the referee if he thinks there's danger. If he thinks there's a big problem, they will ignore him. They will get on there, right? So I've talked to plenty of physios about this, and there's a kind of nod and a wink. If there's a serious injury, ignore the referee, get on there, right? Head injuries is different. Let's ignore that. There's a rule for that. We understand that. So I'm not against, you know, changing the rule and saying, right, okay, let them on and let them play around. Let's have a go at that. Trial it out and see if it works. That might get rid of that problem. So I have no problem with that. The problem I've actually got, and it's a real moral dilemma, they were right to play on.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You should have played on. Now, the only problem is a tiny wee moment when one of the players goes to kick it out. If you've looked as if you're going to kick it out and use that as a scam, right, you should kick it out now. Like, we're all on the same page now. But that was the only difficult moment of it. I'm not for kicking the ball out ever. It's up to the referee.
Yeah.
Because we know what will happen. We know what does happen. People start cheating.
Yeah.
Still allow it.
I recall when they brought in that rule that you had to go off the pitch, and originally it was that you went off the pitch and you were tended off the pitch and play went on, but it's now become accepted that, you know, you get tended to on the pitch and then you go off, you have to go off before you come back on, and it's just become a bit of a joke. But just the way you were talking on Manchester City there, is there some hope in that they're probably not quite playing 100% and they're taking on a Leicester side that is obviously in an absolute high at the moment and probably will not fear them in the Etihad?
Well, I think the last word in your sentence was the most important one. Etihad.
Yeah.
They're playing at home. They don't make many mistakes at home. Yeah, they're missing De Bruyne. One or two players are looking tired. But honestly, that is some place to go and play. They're much, much better there. The pitch is really, really big. They can soak it as much as they like. And they've just got the fans behind them. So if it was at Leicester, you know, I think Leicester's last home game, they've got Chelsea at home, actually, off the top of my head. That would have been more difficult and that would have been more concerning. It's not an absolute foregone conclusion. You can't say that this season. Would I be that worried if I was a City fan just now about that game? Nah, I think they're easily good enough, with one possible exception, which I think everyone spotted. Vincent Kompany's not lightning quick anymore, and Jamie Vardy still is. There's a problem for you. It was a real difficulty for you. So if they can manage to manipulate that situation, because Kompany was brilliant against, absolutely brilliant against Burnley, but he's not got anybody running at him. He's just playing against big, you know, hefty centre forwards. If you get somebody who's clever, like the Rashford kind of thing, or Vardy, that'll ask a different question, because in simple terms, he's not quick enough anymore against those players. So that's their only danger, I think.
So meanwhile, the Manchester United fans reportedly start cheering when they hear that City have scored, and it's put out there that this is really a little indication of the decline of this club, that they're actually cheering their cross-city rivals doing Liverpool won. What do you make of the situation at Old Trafford at the moment?
God, I find it's so confusing, that whole thing. But I just understand certain clubs can't stand each other. Certain fans of certain clubs can't stand each other. But it's kind of secondary. None of that's in any way important at all to Manchester United. That's just a tiny little victory somewhere in the distance. That's nothing got to do with who Manchester United are. What Manchester United are should be something much better than that. And looking what's happened this season, and looking at the group of players there and the way they've been playing recently, and this inability to go and fight and battle and chase and be bothered to put 100% in every single week, it just shows that there's not a spirit there. And also the leadership. Now, I'm not blaming Ole Gunnar Solskjaer for this, because you need leadership within the group as well, within the playing group. It's one of the most common things. It doesn't matter what your sport is. It could be rugby, it could be NFL, it could be, you know, football, you name it. See the guy who's the most important character, often the captain, but not always the captain. See if he's the kind of influence that's not getting you all together and getting you to work with the right spirit. You've got a problem. I'm looking at that team and I'm thinking, I don't know who it is. And see if it's someone like Pogba. You've got a problem, because Pogba's all about Pogba. Pogba's not all about the team. He's a great player, fantastic player when he does it. But you need someone who you can core build it around. When I'd ask both of you, who would you say it is? I can't tell who it is.
I think that it's actually a very hard question. And we spoke about this over the weekend a bit, that like when you don't have that figure at all, it's not as if there's another player who doesn't have the armband or is a sort of a newer member to the club that is emerging with those attributes. I'm not sure what that player is at all in the squad. And where do you start then in terms of, like, you do a rebuilding process as a manager. I assume you try to build it around certain players or certain things you can rely on. I'm not sure where it is. I mean, where do you, is there any other names that spring to mind in the younger group?
It's not obvious. I mean, everybody, we all like McTominay, and he's had a couple of really good games, you know, and his spirit's really good. You remember, very similar, it was Darren Fletcher. He was a youngster with that group, and he was coming outsider and not as talented as the others. And then slowly but surely, over the years, for a long time, he started becoming the one you looked to and thought, actually, he's not nowhere near the most talented player in that group. But they're all having to react off him because of his attitude. So, you know, I'm not just saying it because it's another young Scotsman in the midfield there. But it could be that he could grow into that. But it doesn't happen overnight. He's too young and he needs more experience. And certain players never will look up to anyone else if they're only concerned about themselves. But it's definitely a big problem there. And it may well be that one of the multitude of centre-backs they've got there could have become that player. But none of them have, you know, got the set place as their own place over any period of time. And it's just the personality isn't... It's not saying they're all terrible personalities, but you want something special. And you know yourself, if it's Keno, you know, if it's Brian Robson before that, if it's all sorts of players you could talk over the years with Manchester United, there's no one even close to that just now. And I can't see where you get one at the moment, because you need more than one. As you say, you need more than one. You need to build something bigger. I'm not saying it's all doom and gloom, by the way. They could end up getting the top four. I don't think they will get in the top four. But, I mean, the madness of this season, like anything else, I'm not writing anything off yet. But their run has been quite poor over this. I mean, the odd thing is, you have a look at them all. If you ask any of the supporters, you ask Chelsea fans, how are your team doing just now? Oh, terrible. Absolutely awful. Spurs fans, how's your team doing? Oh, terrible. Awful. Arsenal? Oh, we're terrible. Awful. These are all the top, you know, 3-6 position in the league. It's a weird season.
Yeah, there was a weekend recently where they picked up 1 point between them, the four of them. But do you envisage a mass purge at Old Trafford from Solskjaer? What's he got to do? Will Pogba say?
Far too easy to say that, much more difficult to do. It's just financially, there are certain players that have still got contracts and you've not got a choice. And who else is going to pay the money they're getting paid? Very, very, very few. So unless you take a hit and a loss on it and make very little money out of the actual sales, it's hard to move them on. So, you know, it takes... We always want everything to happen right away. You know, being in the game a long time, you realise something like that takes a few years. Thing is, they've been trying to do that few years for quite a few years already. You know, Moise came in, you know, and Van Gaal came in, and Mourinho came in, and nobody's really done it. And it doesn't actually look any particularly further ahead than it was before. I don't think so anyway. It just looks as if you still need to completely resurrect what is a spirit and a group and a team. And it's the easiest thing in the world to say, and it's one of the hardest things to do. Especially if, as we suspect, they won't have Champions League football next season. So you're asking for an answer. The answer is, they haven't got enough money to do that. I don't think anyone has. But on the other hand, there's a couple of other teams around the world that are like that as well. If you're Chelsea, you're feeling the same way. If you're Real Madrid, you might be feeling the same way as well.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose one player that doesn't have a long contract is David De Gea. But I don't know where we see this one, how you see this one playing itself out, because there is a lot of spotlight on him again. Pat, and I don't know what your take on it is. Is he caught up in a general malaise, or is it just a, you know, a personal form crisis that he's suffering? But it seems to be one that's just recurring again and again.
You know, he's worked. Remember the way when he came in? If it's a long way to remember back, but he was getting dogs abuse. Because he looked too light, he wasn't commanding of his area. Everyone accepted he was a good shortstopper, but you know, there was so many questions asked about him, and it took a long time for us all to realize actually he's got some pretty extra special skills about him. And see, when you think about that period, he fought and battled it for a year and a bit, wasn't it? And then he got over that period, he's never had a dip. I don't really remember, he's had the odd mistake, but he's never had a dip. So we don't know what he's like under pressure, if the confidence is rattled a little bit. Nobody kind of knows, because it's such a long, long time that. And it may well just be that. He's had a dip in form. And now we're seeing how he reacts to that sort of pressure. And it's massive. It's amazing how differently he looks. I mean, that Alonso following that ball in there to get that tap in, you probably wouldn't have bothered following that ball in a wee while ago against the hair. You'd have just left it and accepted that that was... So, you know, that's what we'll find out over the next wee while. I'll be honest with you, I'd be wanting to keep him. Because if you get rid of him, you got to look at somebody else. How many keepers can you absolutely trust to go in there, be a Manchester United goalkeeper, have the big enough personality? It's kind of, they're not cheap, those guys. They cost a lot of money.
Just before we wrap up, those of us watching on the stream, you gave the look there like your house was going to be burgled or you smelled something in the oven. Is everything okay?
Well, I had a really worrying moment there in the corner of my eye. My wife was just about to bring me a cup of tea.
That's always a worry.
She put any sugar.
Oh, no. Thanks as ever, Pat.
Pleasure, guys. See you soon.
Thanks, Pat.
We're going to talk more about Shane Long after the break, because we had Gary Breen on Off the Ball AM discussing his recent surge in form, so that's all upcoming.
Some of the boys are really obsessed with me, and some of them, they will wake up in the morning. As always, the first thing they think that comes to their mind is Jose Mourinho.
I'm European champion, so I'm not one of the bottle. I think I'm a special one. And... I'm sorry, I'm a bit arrogant. We have a top manager.
Until the moment they have a manager that wins four Premier Leagues for them, I'm the number one. Because when I left the club last season, I left the club in the Champions League, winning the Champions League group, qualifying to the Champions League knockout phase, playing the second leg at home with the advantage to be the champion of the group. So if they win the Champions League last year, they could be playing in Europe this season. So. It's not my fault, it's the fault that the ones that stay here and didn't win the Champions League.
3-0. Do you know what this means? 3-0. But also means 3 premierships, and I won more premierships alone than the other 19 managers together. 3 for me and 2 for them. Respect, 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 man.
And you're welcome back. Daniel McDonald is still here in studio with me. Gary Breen, meanwhile, was on this morning's Off the Ball AM, which you can watch on our social channels, Facebook, Twitter and YouTube. It's live Monday to Friday at 7:45 a.m. And here's Gary talking about Shane Long's recent return to goal-scoring form.
The Irish strikers are starting to score some goals. The Shane Long revolution, more goals in April than Man United, I think, was one of the stats that was doing there. It's a draw now. Apparently Man United have drawn level. So... maybe he's drawn well, level with United.
So I'm delighted for Shane, because it's been a hard slog for him at times, and he's not a player who ever shies away from putting a shift in, but it must have had a really debilitating effect on your confidence. Of course it will do. So if he's scoring goals, he turns up for the Ireland squad in the summer with confidence. We've got a player who can run in behind. It does bode well. You think of how well McGoldrick had played as well at Sheffield United. So it's certainly looking a lot brighter.
Just one last point on Shane Long. It just kind of struck me the other day that Shane Long still got his opportunity in the Premier League. It wasn't like his bad form through various different managers, let's admit here, kind of resulted in him getting sold to a championship club or going down the divisions or anything like that. He was still a Premier League striker. So there was clearly something being seen in Shane Long at a Premier League level. And clearly we've maybe judged statistics a little bit too much in this respect. Granted, it is the most important statistic when it comes to being a goal scorer. But perhaps there was an underlying thing about Shane Long that allowed him to continue to play at that level.
Yeah, I think so. You're right. I think a lot of managers will probably say, well, look at the outlet he gives us with that pacing behind. He unsettles defences. We've seen him do it numerous times. But it's whether or not he had that finishing ability that, and I heard the comments there, that there are times when he goes on a good scoring spree and it dries up for him again. But I think what he ultimately gives you is that energy, that work rate. He never shies away from that. And that's what managers will like. They probably won't hang their hat on him to get the vital goal at a vital time, but certainly have an impact on that. And, you know, listen, he's a strong, quick centre forward. He doesn't give centre halves a moment's peace. So he's still a great squad player, even if he's not doing particularly well in that starting 11.
Psychologically, it's so strange. You go so long where you literally can't do anything right, and all of a sudden you're able to score almost blindfolded. And it just seems to show the importance of having a positive attitude or whatever, or just confidence.
Confidence, yeah. Because I was over in Southampton not long ago, and they were playing Fulham, and it was actually a big interview with Long on the programme. And he was speaking about how, actually, ironically, how he doesn't like doing interviews, and that certainly would be something that would be striking. Even people have been around the Irish beat for some time, you wouldn't say a huge lot. You would sort of steer clear of, the microphones and the chats. And I don't know. I mean, that could just be, listen, I don't really have an issue. Players just might not want to do it. That's fine. But I often wondered as well if, like, his form and his situation was also contributing to that. Because even through Shane Long's Irish career, I remember going back to Serbia in 2012, where he basically actually, there was a couple of us standing outside, and he effectively hadn't played in the game. I think Trapattoni said he was injured. Long told us walking past he wasn't injured. And there was this sense, even with his Irish career, that he's always been frustrated by not getting a run of games, not being picked. And I'd say even in recent times in Southampton, hasn't been picked. And if he does interviews, the whole tone of the questions is, you're not scoring many goals. What's happening? You haven't been played. What's going on? It's almost like a negative.
He's on the back foot straight away.
Yeah, he's on the back foot. And I think, listen, at the same time, I mean, Shane Long's been very well paid for the majority of his career. He's been on good contracts. He's done very well out of football. And there would be an unsympathetic view from the other side of things of saying, well, listen, you know, he's been lucky, you know, to do what he's done, you know, to be almost earning what he has and keeping that standing when he hasn't necessarily delivered over a couple of seasons. But the ability's always been there. You know, there's no doubt that maybe he hasn't, maybe didn't turn into the player that people thought he might at 21, 22. 23, but he still has scored like over 50 Premier League goals. I think he's only the fourth Irish player to do that. He's scored across a number of successive seasons. In the modern Premier League, where it's so hard, we talk about globalisation and competitiveness, and like to do what he's done and stay at the top level for the majority of his career, is still very laudable. Like,
but it is
being judged by a very high standard, and I think he knows himself that it hasn't been good enough over the period of time. And he did say it during the week that he can't go in and talk about a new contract when he's up at the end of next season. Because he almost, how could he? You know, like he'd be on a good deal. And I'd say if he went knocking on the door to ask questions, I mean, he'd be facing, yeah, well, we might talk about that, but it'll be X amount rather than what you're on at the moment. So it's a big year for him. Because where does he go from, like, where does he see the rest of his career playing out? Oddly enough, he hasn't played a huge amount of football in the last couple of years, so I'm not sure if, like, wear and tear and fatigue, it might be as much of a concern for him as it might be for other players for whom it catches up on them. I mean, he's been almost an impact sub for large parts of his career. So maybe there's more in the tank. But
is there enough in the tank that he's a big challenger to McGoldrick, or at least come off the bench against Denmark?
It's mad that you're even talking about the language of him being a challenger to McGoldrick when, like, McGoldrick wasn't, you know, didn't travel to the Euros in 2016 when Long played. McGoldrick's been behind him for all of his career, really, with Ireland
as well.
Until now. It's a different type of game, different type of player for a different type of game. I think with Ireland, sometimes the managers would feel that there's one up front a lot of the time. They need to be very good but back to goal and holding the ball up and bringing others into the game. And that hasn't really always been Shane Long's game. With Martin O'Neill, Darren Murphy, he basically began to trust him more in that position. Now, Long, I remember Johnny Walters saying one time that actually he always enjoyed playing with Long as a two, and that maybe Long is better suited to having a partner than necessarily leading the line like Kevin Doyle would have, like very comfortable at leading the line on his own. So it depends what you're looking for in a particular game. Like in Denmark away,
Ilall with 20 minutes left?
That might be the scenario where he's brought on. If you, unfortunately, it's come back to a stereotypical view that when the other team is pushing, he might, on the break, give you something and stretch them. Whereas is McGoldrick the better hold-up player and, you know, bringing other players into the game like he did against Georgia, if you want to keep the ball in your half for longer, in the opposition half for longer. So I'm not sure if he's going to play two of them together away in Denmark. I'd be very surprised. I think from listening to McCarthy speak about playing, you know, three in the middle, I think that's something he's going to do for the bigger game. So it's very possible that Long still misses out no matter what form he's in.
Patrick Hooven was mentioned in some sort of kind of
scouting report. Yeah,
scouting report.
Well,
this, I think you might have spoken to Vinnie Perth after the Knock Rovers game on Friday, but Vinnie spoke, I think Vinnie's comment was something to the effect that players have played for Ireland who've achieved less than Patrick Hooven. Now, Patrick Hooven, obviously...
He made a comment last week, but I think he wasn't saying
he should be in the squad.
No, I don't think Vinnie was necessarily too happy with how that was interpreted, because then Mick McCarthy followed up on it and became a bit of a thing.
It's been put to me over the weekend by a guy I'd respect that he doesn't really think that Mick necessarily values the League of Ireland in terms of bringing players in, despite Jack Byrne. But where do you think he stands in terms of League of Ireland? Because he's been at a lot of games.
Oh yeah, he's been to a lot. I mean, he's signed players from League of Ireland over the years. But the problem for any form of experimentation now, and this can extend,
we don't have time,
is that the nature of his gig. You know, like, he brought James Collins in from Luton, League One, to the games in March. He's been fantastic this season, Collins, like top player in League One. He missed the game for Luton, didn't get him on the pitch. You know, even in Gibraltar away, you would have thought, no, didn't get him on the pitch. You know, in another time, if a manager was having four or five friendlies before his first competitive match, it's possible that the likes of Collins, maybe a Hooban or a Michael Duffy or a Jack Byrne or whoever would get on the pitch and get a few minutes and, okay, there's a training camp in Portugal and we'll see if players are involved in the playoffs, who he brings on that. I don't think Mick's doing it for any, coming to games for any
tokenism.
Because I think the reality of where we're at now is that if you were to say, well, where are our top 20 players? They're all in England. But if you go to top 40, top 50, you're definitely bringing lads into the mix that are here without a shadow of a doubt. But just his scope for friendly matches is non-existent almost this year. There's a date in September and a date in November, at which point the campaign is really at the business end. So I don't think that there's going to be that chance that, you know, Martin Neil played seven games almost before he had a proper match. So that's not the case for McCarthy. So regardless of what his view might be, I don't think it's ever going to be tested really anyway.
We're going to Leon Bland shortly, but just finally on this, Sean Maguire, any concerns about his general form?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I don't think he's necessarily been scoring goals. But actually, Preston's results improved dramatically when he came back in. Maybe himself, he hasn't been scoring a huge amount, and maybe sometimes his work has been making space for others.
He was playing up front, and now he's kind of back.
He's moved out at the weekend. I mean, Alan Brown scored a lot of goals from midfield. Now, like, he's had an interrupted season. I think he needs, really, for him, a full pre-season and to hit an English season, a full crack at an English season without any interruptions, and let's see what he can do. But I wouldn't be worried. I think it's just a natural process from what has been a very stop-start 18 months from, really, since he burst onto the scene.
We're not in a bad way, though, going into Denmark anyway, generally, just the way the players are finishing the campaign.
The thing is, like, obviously, some of the players the problem is, some of the guys are in great form. It's going to be a month between their last championship game in Denmark, so form, I mean, I don't know.
Shane Long's streak going to continue without
playing? At least Long will be playing a bit longer, but the guys in the championship, Sheffield United lads, it is a long break, so the June break can be funny sometimes for lads to sort of get going and get up and going again. There's a lot of things that have to be monitored. There could be lads that might be under the power now that actually could be peaking when June comes around.
We're going to talk to Leon Blanche from our football sponsor, Boyle Sports, very shortly. In the course of this discussion, we will be referring to betting odds and gambling. If you're affected by this type of content, you can check out of the conversation now. And do remember to gamble responsibly. For more, check gamblerware.ie or visit dunlewy.net. That's dunlewey.net. We're just going to go to the ads now, and after that, we have Leon.
Remember lying back, pillows on me bed late after, and looking up the top of my wardrobe, stacked with boxes of Morro bars, Batch Loaf, not the heels. And butter's another thing. Over the last couple of years, I've gone back, because I wouldn't have tasted butter for about 15, 20 years. Yeah, bread, bread was a big thing for me when I went over to England. I missed it. Vienna rolls.
Toast.
Oh, rings of pudding used to, sausages, my ma used to, they used to be packed in the luggage compartment on a...
Surely they did sausages as well.
Right now.
English sausages would
have been... Ah, no, their Irish recipe, which is a nowhere near, is it?
I've had sausages of, Grim Stag Weekend over in the UK, and they've tasted okay, no?
If they're sausages in a Grim Stag Weekend, Joe. You want to be able to savour the sausage.
Ma bring back the batch, cut a big heel, open up, eat the heel, flip it over, go for the heel down the bottom, wrap it back up again, flip it back over, put it back in the bread bin so nobody's aware of it until they dug down right at the end. Although there's something nice about toast, putting the butter, if a cold slab of butter on top and just watching it work its way across the toast slowly.
So true.
As God intended. No, just Vienna rolls, that fresh bread, not going to the Super Queen, the bread coming out, breathe it in.
And Leon, how are you?
Good evening, Johnny. How are you?
Not too bad. It's an exciting Champions League semi-final matchup. Probably, well, definitely, I think, not the ones that people expected. But what do you make of it?
Yeah, look, I think Spurs obviously taking on Ajax. Ajax have been the team of the tournament, without a shadow of a doubt, in my opinion. They're young. They're enthusiastic. They play a great brand of football. It's going back to that super Dutch philosophy. In terms of keeping the ball down, pass and move, and the way they get the ball back when they lose it, Johnny. I mean, they went to Juve and they totally outplayed Juventus in that second leg, thoroughly deserved their spot in the semi-final. And a lot of people are saying Ajax could see off Spurs with a little bit to spare. I mean, there's no Harry Kane, there's no Son. So I think those two players missing for Tottenham at home tomorrow. Spurs are favourites to win the leg at 6-4. Ajax are 9-5. And the draw here is 11-5. I think if you're Pochettino, you'd be hoping you can get a similar scoreline to the one that when you beat Man City 1-0. But I just don't know whether Tottenham at the moment are good enough to keep this Ajax team scoreless. It's going to be a very, very interesting first leg tie. Ajax are slight favourites to qualify for the final at 3-4. And you can have Spurs at even money. But unfortunately for Tottenham, I think, Johnny, without Kane and without Son in this first leg, I think they're going to be up against it.
Yeah, it's very interesting in terms of just Ajax suddenly favourites to qualify for a Champions League final. The Liverpool game, is it any help to Liverpool that they may sort of half consider that the league is gone now and that the Champions League might be more of a focus for them?
Yeah, probably. I think looking at, obviously, yesterday's game, Burnley, when Man City should have had a definite penalty, when it wasn't given, I think a lot of Liverpool fans and players would have been thinking maybe this is the game that will shift the title race in our favour, but City didn't. They came back and they got that 1-0 victory. So Liverpool, look, they have a great pedigree in Europe, Johnny. They were at the final last year. We all know what happened. The keeper made two absolute howlers and Real Madrid won it. But Liverpool, at the minute, they're going to the new camp. They are the massive underdogs at 16-5. Barca are 5-6 and the draw here is 13-5. I think when you look at Liverpool, though, you probably fancy them to score anywhere they go. They just have enough players who are on fire at the minute. Salah and Mane have got 20 goals in a Premier League season. Will Firmino be fit? I don't know. Messi is the favourite to score first at 5-2. But when you're looking at the likes of Salah 7-1, Mane 8-1 just to score the first goal, you'd never get odds on those two players in the Premier League at any stage of the season, no matter who they're playing against. They would never be as big a price as 7 or 8-1 to score first. And in the qualify market, Liverpool are the underdogs at 21-20 and Barcelona are 7-10. I think, Johnny, both of these games, I think for the football fans out there, they should be two cracking ties. I think and I hope there's going to be goals in both of them and made the best two teams qualify for the final in the Atletico Madrid stadium.
Absolutely, Leon. We'll see you in Punchestown.
Absolutely, Johnny. Looking forward to it. Looks like it's going to be the WP show. He looks to have a serious team going for the coming week. And he's probably going to win our race tomorrow, the champion chase. Min, I think, is 8-13 favourite, but I think he's got the first three in the betting. So, look, we all know how important Punchestown is to Willie. He's proved that over the last number of years. He just has so much ammunition to fire the next 5 days. But looking forward to a great week.
Thanks very much to Leon Blanche from our sponsor, Boyle Sports. For more information, see offtheball.com/Boyle Sports. And remember to gamble sensibly. If you're in need of help or advice, see dunlewy.net. That's dunlew.net. Dan, thanks for coming in.
Cheers, Johnny.
And that is our lot for tonight. Off the Ball AM is back tomorrow morning on Facebook, YouTube and Twitter at 7:45 a.m. An absolute feast here if you're a Galway hurling fan, because Gareth McInerney is going to be in studio with the lads. And Katie McCabe, who's absolutely flying at Dan as well. She's going to be
they
on.
Won the Arsenal won the Women's Premier League over the weekend.
Cracking footballer.
So Katie McCabe and Louise Quinn involved, yeah.
Yeah, so Katie and Gareth will both be in tomorrow morning. We're back at 7 p.m. with Clare hurler Peter Duggan, and Kenny Cunningham will be with us all night as Spurs play Ajax. Tom Dunn is up next. Have a good night.
Give him a ball and he out of grass. He'll give you a move for the perfect pass. Give him a ball and he out of space. He'll give you a move with godly grace. Ra-ta-ta-ta.